completed. Good morning. Before I call the first case of this morning, I understand that we have a high school students visiting with us, and I have Sussex Hamilton High School. If my notes are correct, would you all stand, please? Oh, wonderful. Thank you. You may be seated. We'd like very much to have you all come and visit us. The students participate in the program called Court with Class that the Supreme Court sponsors along with the State Bar of Wisconsin. And generally, the students will meet with the justice after oral argument is concluded to talk a little bit about how the Supreme Court functions. Today, I understand that you all don't have time to do that, but nevertheless, we're very pleased to have you with us today and hope that you will return on a regular basis. Let's see. I have asked you to stand and be introduced, and so let me introduce the court to you. Beginning on my far right-hand side, Justice Michael Gableman. Next to Justice Gableman, Justice David Prosser. Next to Justice Prosser, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. Next to me on my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left is Justice Annette Ziegler. And on the far left is Justice Rebecca Bradley. With those introductions in line, I'll now call State versus James, is it Largone? Largone. Thank you very much. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Caitlin Lamb, and I represent James Largone. Both the United States Supreme Court and this court have held that a criminal defendant's right to testify on his own behalf is a fundamental right. In this case, the state is asking the court to make an exception to the right to testify, that the right to testify does not apply at the second phase of a bifurcated criminal proceeding.
Can I ask you at the outset, are there any limits? And what you just said was pretty broad. In any proceeding, in any case, at any time, that right attaches?
I believe that it would depend on the type of proceeding. So in this particular case, my position is that because it is part of a criminal case, which it's been clearly established that there is a fundamental constitutional right to testify, that because it's part of the criminal case, that in this particular proceeding, that the right to testify is fundamental and
so
should apply.
Let me just ask you a little bit. Clearly, a preliminary hearing is part of a criminal case. So should judges be giving colloquies at preliminary hearing stage, sentencing stage, competency hearing stage, every single part of a criminal case?
I do not believe that should be the case, but I would note that would be a issue for a separate case. So in this particular case, I'm just focusing on the bifurcated trial proceeding.
Is there a statute?
I'm not being unfriendly, but that's why at the beginning when you said you have a right, it seemed like it was limitless, and we could write a case that then is interpreted to be quite limitless. You know what I'm saying? So what I need to hear from you is, what's the test and how do you get there? How do you know this is the type of proceeding where you have that kind of right? Because clearly there are other proceedings where you do or don't. And there are even occasions like in 980s or in the other part of an NGI. Let's say someone is found NGI. And then they come back on the competency part that they can petition the court. The legislature has specifically outlined the right to remain silent in that scenario. Or in 980s, the legislature has specifically spoken on those scenarios. So do you see what I'm saying? I like your argument. I think it's interesting. It sounds good. How do you write it, and how do you make the test clear as to when it does and when it doesn't apply? And does the legislature have any role at all in deciding that? And when they didn't put it in this part of the statute, does that mean anything? Lots of questions, but all those things factor into what you very first said, which is why I stopped you there.
Yes, Your Honor, and I absolutely agree. I do not mean to discuss whether it applies in other proceedings. I just wish to focus on this particular, the second phase of the bifurcated trial proceeding. And the reason for that is I would ask that because this is part of a criminal case, that the right to testify apply at the second phase. And I would also
then I'm not going to take up all your time because I respect my colleagues and I want them to have a chance to ask you questions before your time is up today. But then you got to give me the test as to why this is part of a criminal proceeding and other things aren't part of the criminal proceeding. See the difference?
Yes.
Okay.
And so to clarify, I would just note that I am indicating that this right is coming from both the United States Supreme Court Constitution and also from the Wisconsin Constitution. And so in this case, it should apply, or the reasons that it should apply would be, first of all, this right has been held to be fundamental in a general criminal proceeding. And in Wisconsin, the legislature has specifically passed a statute which includes both parts of the case. So the second phase is remaining a part of the criminal case. And if the legislature had chosen to make this just a completely separate proceeding, a special proceeding, or a civil proceeding, it could have done so.
What about Caput, where they said that it was a special proceeding?
I agree that it's a special proceeding, has a different nature, but the fact that it still remained in that specific statute, which I believe the title of the chapter 971 is called Criminal Proceedings Before and After Court. So I do not mean to suggest that it is completely criminal, as you pointed out, Your Honor, in Caput. It is a special proceeding. It has a special nature. But despite this, this right to testify should still apply at that second phase. As I was noting, the fact that the legislature has not completely split this off to make it a completely separate civil proceeding is one term or one reason in favor of it. In addition, I would note that the Court of Appeals has also previously indicated that the right to remain or the right against self-incrimination applies at this second phase. Caput, well, it did find that the unanimous verdict was not required, like in a criminal case. What's important about that case is that Caput was actually in protection or in favor of the defendant. It's the defendant's burden at the second phase to prove that he was insane. And so in that reason, well, Caput saying it's a special proceeding, the ruling in that case was actually favorable to the defendant. Likewise, continuing on through the legislative history, if you look at the next case in line, which is State versus Murdoch, again, there was a ruling that is serving to protect the defendant. There they found that the criminal jury trial waiver statute applies. And so the theme that is running through this is protection of the defendant. And so I believe that it would be consistent to find that the right to testify does in fact apply at this second phase of the proceedings.
Is it structural error?
I believe that in this case, so as you are aware, in Nelson, the court said that it was not structural error, that the harmless error applies to the right to testify. But I would distinguish Nelson based from this case, because here we're concerned about the intentional and knowing waiver of a right. We're talking about a colloquy. And so for that reason, I would assert that it would be structural error. It's much different from an instance where, such as in Nelson, where there was a colloquy, the defendant knew that she had the right to testify. It was just a matter of whether or not that right was being asserted or that right was being exercised. And so getting on to a later part of the argument, it was my position that Nelson is distinguishable, and for that reason, harmless error does not apply, and it would fall into one of those structures, because we're talking about, once again, we're talking about a colloquy and an intentional and knowing waiver of the right to testify.
You know, in an NGI, if you had a trial and both phases went to the jury, in the first phase, it's pretty clear the judge would engage in that colloquy. The defendant could decide to testify or not. It implicates a number of constitutional rights, Fifth Amendment, among others, right? 6th, 14th, et cetera. Wisconsin Constitution is a little different, which I don't know if you're going to address whether that is implicated here at all or not. But, I mean, that's easy. The guilt or innocence phase is easy. You have the right, and the judge has to have a discussion with you or should, right? When you move on, though, and the exact same jury hears the second phase, which the not the state, but the defendant has the burden of proof, and it's not unanimous, it's not unanimity that's required, it's a 5-6 verdict, it's a different creature, the second stage, but the same jury, I know that didn't happen here, but this case would apply to that. The same jury would hear that second phase. I'm looking back on, both as a lawyer and a judge, trying to remember a time when a judge crafted a different jury instruction in the second phase than the one that's been around for a long time, which doesn't have that same kind of defendant has the right to testify, if the defendant doesn't testify, you can't use that against sort of thing. So were all those cases wrong? Were all those juries tried incorrectly?
So a couple of points, and please interrupt me if I don't answer quite everything. So
I know, I'm throwing a lot at you. I'm sorry.
First of all, I think that the right to testify at the second, it is undoubtedly important at the first phase, but it's also important at the second phase, and there are two primary reasons for that. First of all being that, as I mentioned earlier, the defendant has the burden, and so it makes it very important that a defendant is aware of the right and knows that he or she can testify at that second phase. So that's the first reason why it's so important, and in fact maybe arguably even more important, because it's up to the defendant to meet their burden. And then second, there are still really important liberty interests at stake at this second phase. This phase is determining whether or not the individual is planning on will be sent to prison or whether or not the individual may possibly be committed to a mental hospital. So for those two reasons, it's still the right to testify is an important right, and it should apply at the second phase. And so there are, once again, there are differences. It is a special proceeding, differences in nature, but there are still rights that have been found constitutional rights to apply. And just because it's a special proceeding doesn't mean that a person shouldn't have any constitutional rights. For instance, as I was indicating before, the Court of Appeals has found that the privilege against self-incrimination applies at the second phase. Additionally, I think that there would be a due process right that a person would have at the second phase, the right to present a defense. So just because this is a different phase doesn't mean that there should not be any constitutional rights. Constitutional rights such as the right to testify and the right against self-incrimination are fundamental rights that should be applied in this second phase. And for the reasons, as I was stating before, it's the defendant's burden. So it's important that the defendant is aware and knows of this right. And additionally, there are these important liberty interests at stake. So the defendant should have the opportunity and be aware that he can get up on the stand and he can testify as to what he was experiencing at the time of the incident, how this illness affected his actions, and why he needs the help or treatment, and the reason that he wasn't sane at the time of the offense. And so for that reason, I think that this court should find that the right to testify applies at the second phase.
And is it your position? I'm sorry, are you done answering all those questions? Are you done?
Yes.
So is it your position that Article 1, Section 7 applies to the NGI phase? Article 1, Section says, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be heard by himself and counsel and to meet the witnesses face-to-face and to have compulsory process to compel the attendance of a witness in his behalf.
Yes, it's my position that that constitutional right would apply at the second phase.
Does it apply at preliminary hearings?
I don't know the answer to that, and I just, as I was mentioning before, I think that's just a completely separate issue for a different case, and so I would
think to figure out what a criminal prosecution is, because that's what Section 7 applies to. So, you know, then I can just pick various things, like sentence. Is that part of the criminal prosecution?
Yes, and once again, I think just the preliminary hearing and the sentencing are different issues that I would not feel qualified or comfortable discussing today, since this case is specifically focusing on the second phase of a bifurcated trial. And so I'm happy to follow up with that as well and look into it further.
Is the NGI part of the trial a statutory right, or is it found elsewhere?
So it is a statutory right. I do know the United States Supreme Court has not said that it's a constitutional right, but I don't think the fact that it's a statutory right impacts whether or not the constitutional rights apply. So once a proceeding starts and is undergoing, such as in this case, once there's that bifurcated trial that starts, I do think that there are rights that apply once the proceeding goes. So just the fact that it is not, or it is a statutory right, I do not think implicates, because if we said that, once again, I think the ruling that would come out of that would be that there would never be any constitutional rights at the second phase. And as I indicated before, I think that a person has a due process constitutional right at the second phase. The Court of Appeals has found that the right against self-incrimination applies at the second phase. And so to me, that does not have any bearing on this particular argument.
My concern was more basic than that. My concern was, if you don't even have a right to have an NGI hearing, absent the statute, how can it be a violation of that right not to include one proceeding or another? That's what I'm concerned with.
So it's just my position, once again, that once this right actually, or once this proceeding actually commences and once this proceeding begins, that at that point there are certain constitutional rights that you have. You know, the right to effective assistance of counsel, perhaps, or the due process right. And so I think that once it starts, the right would attach. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Once there's a statutory right given, then implementation of that right has to fit all the constitutional doctrines. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, could you please repeat that?
I said if you have a statutory right to a proceeding, then when you implement that statutory right, it has to be implemented in a constitutional way. So you got to get notice. You got to have, depending on the right, jury, and maybe the statute itself gives the jury right. You have to have a due process of other sorts than notice. So if there's a statutory right, in that statutory right comes constitutional rights. You can't just give a statutory right and then take away constitutional rights within that statutory proceeding. I think there are cases that say that.
Yes, Your Honor, that was put a lot more eloquently than how I was expressing it.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals here said we don't have to address this substantive issue because here we have harmless error. What's your argument with regard to the application of harmless error in this case?
So my argument is that harmless error should not apply in this case. As I was discussing before, Nelson specifically dealt with the assertion or the exercise of a right. In that case, there was a colloquy involved, and so it was dealing more with the court not allowing her to get up on the stand and testify. And so I think that this case is different. I think that this case falls under the Weed, Denson, Garcia line of cases, where when there's an absence of the colloquy, the defendant can file a post-conviction motion alleging that there was no colloquy and that he or she did not understand the right. And so I think that harmless error does not apply, and I would ask, though, that if the court does decide that Nelson applies retroactively to this case, I would ask in the interest of fairness, just because at the time the motion was filed, that Mr. Legrone be given an opportunity for a remand so that he can amend his pleadings. So just to be entirely clear, at the time he had filed his post-conviction motion, there was the Weed, Denson, Garcia line of cases, and in those cases, there's a suggestion that the defendant just points to the colloquy and then indicates that he or she did not understand and the burden was shifted to the state. And so under those cases, I do believe that Mr. Legrone is entitled to the hearing. However, if the court decides that Nelson, which came later and dealt with the exercise, applies to colloquy cases, then I would ask that this court allow for a remand and an opportunity for Mr. Legrone to amend his pleadings to provide the offer of proof. So my position is that Nelson is inapplicable and that there is no offer of proof required, but in the interest of fairness, I would ask for a remand if the court decides today that that offer of proof was required.
Sorry, how would you amend it?
I believe I would ask for an amendment specifically in terms of if the court says today that this offer of proof is required, I would add in what he would testify to and why this would matter. But it's, once again, just...
Why it's not harmless error.
Yes, if this court does decide that is a requirement. So, but it's my position, just in general, that... Nelson dealt with the assertion of right, and this case is specifically dealing with a colloquy. So I do believe that those are two separate lines of cases.
For a case that this court had, it was written by Justice Diane Sykes, that said a court has to deal with harmless error, the statutory harmless error, which is the general harmless error rule, regardless of whether the parties raise it, because the harmless error statute is addressed to the court. And so you don't have to do anything. And the court doesn't have to even hear from you, I gather, because it's the court's own issue. Do you know what case I'm talking about, since I can't remember it?
I'm not sure offhand which case you are referring to.
I'll find it. Thank you.
So
could I ask, there was a colloquy before the first part of the trial. Is that not right?
Yes.
Why doesn't that apply to the second part of the trial?
Well, first of all, I would note in this particular case, the court did not talk about the right or specifically confirm the right to testify with Mr. Legrone. So there was never at any point a specific comment about Mr. Legrone's making sure he understood the right to testify. I think this case would be perhaps, I do not think Mr. Legrone could have brought this case or would have been able to meet his burden if the court at that first phase had said, do you understand you have the right to testify at the second phase? So there was a colloquy, but once again, the court did not talk to Mr. Legrone about the right to testify at the first phase that he was waiving it. The court did not talk to Mr. Legrone about the second phase that he was waiving the right to testify, so just at no point in the proceedings was there any reference to the right to testify. Once again, I think that perhaps the colloquy conceivably could cover this. It's just in this particular case it did not.
Don't you have another fact in this case, too, that the plea advisement and waiver of rights form specifically indicated that he was not waiving his right to testify at the second phase? Am I stating that accurately?
So, two comments on that. First of all, the court never specifically, once again, confirmed that he understood he had the right to testify at the second phase. Second, I do, as I articulated in my brief, I think that that form was very confusing. I felt like, first of all, there's handwriting on the form. It's not, since there was never a hearing in this case, we don't know whose handwriting this was. And then second, I think that handwriting could be interpreted two ways. It could suggest that you just don't have a right to testify in that second phase, or that you're not excuse me, that you have the right or that you're giving it up. I think that the writing in itself is not clear what it means. And once again, without an evidentiary hearing at which we could have Mr. Legron testify, I don't think that the plea questionnaire is conclusive.
The Court of Appeals interpreted it in its own fashion conclusively. I mean, it indicated, I'm not saying it's correct, it said that next to the phrase was an additional handwritten notation explaining that Legron was giving up his right to testify for phase one, but not for phase two of the proceeding. Why are you reticent to embrace this interpretation of the two that you gave?
So, first of all, I do think that would be a question that would normally be for a fact finder to determine at an evidentiary hearing. And second, I do think that it's ambiguous. It's unclear whether or not it's referring to the right to testify. It's unclear whether or not it's referring to the right to present evidence. It just simply says not for phase two. And I think it's ambiguous what that not for phase two means. Does it mean that he's not giving up the right? Or does it mean that he doesn't have a right at that second phase? And so I think that without the evidentiary hearing, I think it's unclear. And so for that reason, I do think that Mr. Legron had met his burden by, once again, indicating that there was no colloquy at the second phase regarding the right to testify, and additionally that he didn't understand that right. And then it would switch to the state to perhaps make the argument as to why he did, in fact, understand. And so I think that comment on there, it's not known whose is, and I think that it's very ambiguous as to what it says.
You see this as a Bangert case.
Yes, I see this exactly very similar to a Bangert case, where the defendant just simply alleges, there was a defect in the colloquy, and then the defendant alleges that I don't understand, and then the burden switches to the state. Similar to a Bangert case, similar to a case that involves a jury trial waiver, or a case where a person regarding the right to counsel. I see this very similar to that, and I think that this interpretation is consistent with, at the time that I filed the post-conviction motion in this case, very consistent with Garcia, which was stated that the remedy when there's an issue about a colloquy is to grant the evidentiary hearing.
Do you see this as more of a Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment? What are you going under?
So I would say, going off of Roth versus Arkansas, which is a United States Supreme Court case, I would say the 14th, the 6th, and the 5th, all of them, I would say, just which gives the right to testify.
Well, 5th is the right to not be compelled to give self-incriminatory statements.
Yes.
Comes up in the context of the government can't call you to prove its case.
Yes.
Here, you're kind of taking that and turning it around a little bit and saying, what I'm really talking about is I have to prove my case. And I should have been told that I can testify to prove my case. It's different, isn't it?
Well, I would note the Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination and the right to testify, the cases have consistently said that they are corollary rights.
Saying it typically comes up when you can't be required to prove the other side's case. And now you're saying the court should engage in a colloquy when you have to prove your own case. Sort of interesting, right? I'm sorry, I see your red lights on, and I did not intend to ask a question after that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Kate Lloyd, representing the state of Wisconsin. The state is here to ask you to affirm the Court of Appeals' decision affirming Legrone's judgment of conviction. We'd ask you to do so on two grounds. And the first ground, I think I'd like to clarify our first position regarding the fundamental right to testify, or whether there is one, at the NGI proceeding. And I think that this gets to your questions, Justice Siegler, or I hope it does. I think that I, in thinking about this case at about 2 in the morning, I was thinking about how I don't think I articulated it very well. I think perhaps a better way of looking at this would be that our position isn't that there isn't the right to present evidence and that there isn't some constitutional component, maybe a la a parole revocation hearing, as in Morrissey versus Brewster, I think it is, where the Supreme Court discusses that a parole revocation hearing isn't part of a criminal prosecution. You've already been adjudicated guilty, so you don't have the full panoply of rights that you do at a criminal prosecution. You have something different, but you still have the right to present your case and to defend yourself. So what I would say is maybe there is this right to present evidence, perhaps under the Sixth Amendment, to present your case, which could include your right to present testimony, your own, but it's not what we call a fundamental constitutional right. And the fundamental constitutional rights are, at least so far, pretty small in number, like the right to waive a jury trial, the right to testify in the criminal prosecution, which I would say is just the guilt phase, which would eliminate the colloquies that you're discussing at preliminary hearings, et cetera. And then I would say that the fundamental, what we say are fundamental constitutional rights, are those that require personal waivers, that you can't waive.
Let's see if I understand it. Your position is that there is a constitutional right to testify by the defendant at the NGI phase.
I think so.
Okay. It is not a fundamental constitutional right, and the reason that the thing that distinguishes a constitutional right from a fundamental constitutional right is that harmless error applies to a constitutional right, but not a fundamental right.
No, I think a fundamental constitutional right can have harmless error, just like in Nelson. That's the difference between a structural.
Okay. Then what's the difference between a fundamental right and a constitutional right?
Well, my understanding is that the difference is that one requires the defendant to personally waive it, and one can be waived through counsel.
Give me examples of other constitutional rights that are not fundamental.
I would say the right to present evidence.
Boy, isn't, you don't think that's fundamental?
Well, I don't think anyone's held that it's fundamental. I don't think we require a defendant to personally say that they're not presenting evidence at the close of their case. When the defense rests, we let counsel say that on behalf of the defendant.
You know, when I was a circuit court judge and I would go through the colloquy and perhaps it's changed in some ways, and after a few hundreds or thousands of cases, you kind of get the colloquy down. You know, you have a right to testify, you have a right to call witnesses to testify on your behalf and to cross-examine witnesses who are called to testify against you. It was part of the colloquy that I would give, and I thought those were all required.
Well, I'm not saying, I guess, as part of the colloquy, but during the course of trial, when, I mean, cross-examination is a constitutional right, but we don't require the defendant to personally waive cross-examining each and every witness.
No, but then I would end my colloquy with, you understand those rights? You have any questions about those rights? You had an opportunity to discuss those rights with your attorney? I mean, I treated those as though those rights were subject to the requirement that if they are waived, that they be knowing intelligently waived. I may have been mistaken.
Oh, I'm not saying that as part of the colloquy. I'm just talking about during a trial. When during the course of a trial, we let counsel make a lot of those decisions on behalf of their client. And we treat those as constitutional rights that the defendant and the client are going through together, and we don't require a personal waiver for each witness that counsel calls and each witness that counsel cross-examines.
Counsel, I think were you finished with your response?
I hope so. I think so, yes.
The two of us, you would know. You indicated before, I think I heard you say that certainly in order to waive the right at the guilt or innocence phase of the trial, that there would have to be a personal colloquy between the court and the defendant. Yes?
Under Weed, yes.
But that when it came to the mental disease or defect, the NGI phase, that there would not have to be. Is that your position?
Yes.
I wonder, and I'm trying to think, in preparing for this case, I was trying to think out how could it be less so important at the NGI phase, because on the one hand you can say, well, whether someone's going to be committed is a civil issue. It's non-criminal, right? Yes?
Yes.
All right. But in this kind of case, if the defendant does not meet his or her burden, then they wind up, like Mr. Legrone, going to the Wisconsin State prison system. And so I'm trying to wrestle with, and I wonder if you can help me resolve, how it would be less important for the personal colloquy at the NGI phase as it is at the guilt or innocence phase.
Well, I think for the same reasons that we allow the burden to shift and the jury unanimity issue, or the jury doesn't have to be unanimous, it's a different proceeding. The defendant's already been adjudicated guilty, so he doesn't have the full spectrum of rights that he has in the first proceeding. So for that reason, I think we have said that the NGI is just a different creature and he is afforded different rights. Trying to articulate, and perhaps doing it poorly, I still think he has a right to testify. I just wouldn't put it in the category of rights so fundamental that it has to be personally waived.
But when I think about it, I think about the guilt or innocence phase. Typically, in the typical trial, that would be where the crux of the determination whether someone is going to be incarcerated, whether they're going to be deprived of their liberty. And this court, as well as other courts, have recognized the distinction to be made between the deprivation of liberty that results from a civil commitment as opposed to the more severe deprivation of liberty that occurs when someone is placed in the penal system. And so I think you can at least see my point that really the stakes are the same, even though the burden has shifted, as you pointed out. I'm not quite sure that I see that should be the same reason why the right to testify should not be given up only after a personal colloquy. But the stakes are the same. It's prison or not prison.
Yeah, I mean, I just do not see it as something that this court or any other court has held to be one of the few fundamental rights.
Would your parole hearing example be apt here?
That's how I've been thinking of it in the last day or so, 12 hours or so. That also is a liberty interest that can be taken away. You're going to prison for that. I don't know that this court has ever said that there's a personal colloquy requirement at the parole hearing. I mean, that's where this would be going, I would think, that if there's a fundamental right to testify there as well, you have a liberty interest in remaining on parole.
But the rights have already been given up by dint of conviction and placement on supervision by the Department of Corrections in the parole scenario. So those rights have already been determined to have been taken away, to be removed. And so it's black letter that prisoners and probationers and parolees have a lesser expectation in the liberty interest. But here, that's the question. The question is whether the liberty interest should be taken away either into the penal system, the more severe, or the civil commitment system, the less severe. So I'm not sure the analogy is at least persuasive to me.
Yeah, I'm gathering that. Now's
your chance.
Well, I think that's why, I mean, obviously it's not a perfect analogy, but I think that there are things that, just like in Morrissey, where it says, you know, parole is not part of a criminal prosecution, and thus the full panoply of rights to a defendant in such a proceeding does not apply. And I feel that we have that same sort of idea here with the NGI. There's already been an adjudication of guilt, and then we have this burden shifting, which we clearly don't allow in the guilt proceeding. And so I think that maybe with that, there's, in my mind anyway, there's a different way of thinking of what the defendant's rights at the NGI proceeding are. And with that comes, to me anyway, this idea that perhaps this right to present your evidence, that perhaps your right to testify on your own behalf, isn't the same fundamental right that it is at the guilt proceeding.
Justice Prosser has a question.
Okay, great.
No, I don't.
You were making your usual gestures.
I do have a question. I want your position. Seem to say that in the last 12 hours you have re-examined your view. So I would like you to tell us what your view was in your brief and how you are clarifying it here, relating to the, and if I'm not relating it to the right issue, you should tell me. Relating to a defendant's right, constitutional right, to testify at the NGI proceeding.
I think I was trying to get there, and I don't think I quite got there. I think that what I would say now is that
the brief's position.
I think my brief's position just isn't clear. I think that in my heading I say there's no fundamental constitutional right.
That's right.
But then I think I stop inserting the word fundamental sometimes.
Right. And that's how I read it.
Right.
Okay. So you've now seem to be shifted away from the position that there's no constitutional right to testify at the NGI. And your position today, or the state's position today, is that a defendant has a constitutional right to testify.
I think that
the issue is how that is implemented. One, do you have to have a colloquy on that? Two, can it be waived by counsel, or does it have to be waived by the defendant? Is it waived on the record, or can be waived in a conversation with the counsel, et cetera? So
yes.
That's what I hear you say.
That is what I am trying to say, yes. Yes.
So it's a constitutional right to be heard, but it's one that does not need a colloquy at the NGI. Is that right?
I think so. I mean, I don't think the state has any overall problem with colloquies. Courts are doing them, I think, pretty regularly. And, I mean, sometimes I think, as I point out in my brief, I think that the court's concerns in Denson are still there, that sometimes it can perhaps unduly interfere with the client attorney-client relationship. I think that that's a valid concern. From an appellate standpoint, it's nice to have colloquies to look at and make sure everyone understood their rights. But I don't know if saying that there's this fundamental right to testify at this proceeding would lead to unintended consequences that down the road that there's fundamental rights to testify at all sorts of other proceedings. So I don't know that it needs to be classified as fundamental.
So now, if there's a constitutional right to testify at the NGI, there's no colloquy at the NGI, but there had been previously about his right to testify. There was no waiver of that right by the defendant personally at NGI, right?
Right.
In fact, there wasn't a waiver by counsel on the record,
right?
Okay. So the state's position is, without a colloquy, without a personal statement on the record by the defendant, without a statement by counsel on the record that he's not testifying, his constitutional right to testify at NGI has been satisfied. Is that the state's position?
Well, this, you mean in this case because we don't know what he knew? Is that, I'm sorry, I think I can't.
I mean, I want to know if there's a constitutional right which the state now concedes. Doesn't mean we have to accept that concession.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
The state concedes. I want to know how it is implemented. That is, you know, that the state says, okay, constitutional right, but you don't need a colloquy at NGI, right? First colloquy is good enough.
Yeah. I think that in this case, before Nelson, Mr. Legrone's pleadings probably would have been enough to get him an evidentiary hearing to determine if he understood and if he had actually waived it. But I think that after Nelson, if it can be subject to harmless error, and if this court, which it did, if it, assuming that Nelson, the Nelson court, the circuit court, actually violated the defendant's right to testify, if that can be subject to harmless error, then I think that to plead, sufficiently plead to get an evidentiary hearing on whether or not your right to testify or not testify was not properly waived, you need to at least A, say you would have testified, and B, say what that testimony would have been.
So you are by leaps and bounds stepping further and further away from it being a very narrow constitutional right. Because now you basically said to us, well, you would have to show how he personally waived this, okay? Now, there are a lot of rights that you have, a right to cross-examine witnesses, and we generally leave that up to counsel. And if counsel doesn't do it on a witness, we assume counsel has made a decision based on his knowledge as a lawyer. But we don't require the defendant, nor could the defendant in any case that I'm aware of, raise an argument to us that, oh, well, his constitutional right was violated because his lawyer didn't cross-examine Sam Smith and let what was said stand on direct. So you are, whether you mean to or not, your statements in response to Justice Abraham's questions are greatly expanding the rights and requirements for addressing this right.
And part of the question, whether you heard it or not, was you are agreeing that this is a fundamental constitutional right in an NGI case, which I know when we meet back in conference, we're all going to hear that you said from at least some justice on this
Well, I don't know where I said that.
So, because that was part of the question asked you.
Well, I must have missed that then, because I thought I very specifically said it's not a fundamental.
It's because you said there must be a personal waiver. when you were just speaking, before I asked my question, when you were responding to Justice Abrahamson, I mean, we can listen to the tape so we don't need to argue about it, but you said that there was, that the defendant had to personally waive it. Well, if he has to personally waive it, then it's fundamental.
I did not mean to say that.
Well, then I misunderstood, and that's fine.
Right. I'm glad you clarified. I apologize.
Perhaps my ears picked it up incorrectly.
I understood you to say it's constitutional, not fundamental, didn't have to have a personal colloquy, defendant didn't have to personally waive,
right.
Counsel did not have to personally waive.
Right.
Had a constitutional right, but it's waivable, and you don't have to have it waived on the record. That's my understanding of the state's position. And in addition to that, you apply harmless error.
Right.
That's what I understand the state's
position. So you don't think that the defendant has to personally waive this right?
No, I think that what happened here was fine. I think I jumped to the second argument without putting the piece in, which is that if you find that he needed to do something, that the circuit court needed to do something, he still needed to plead more to get the evidentiary hearing.
This, in some ways, the way that your opposing counsel sees it, is a Bangor inadequate colloquy case. The remedy for Bangor inadequate colloquy has been an evidentiary hearing and burden shifting. Tell me why this is not if you lose initially, God forbid, but if you win, and we have to get to harmless error, tell me why it's not a Bangor inadequate colloquy.
Okay, and I think that's what I thought I was answering, and maybe that's where my own wires got crossed. If you find that there needed to be some sort of colloquy and something was inadequate here, I still think that it's not a straight-up Bangor situation, because after Nelson, I think we need more than just there's no longer a knowing, involuntary, intelligent waiver, because I think after Nelson, it's not enough to just not know that you could have, because even in Nelson, if there was a violation, which this court assumed there was a violation, it still held it was harmless. So if let's assume.
May I?
Of course.
Interject. Because your opposing counsel would say, look, Nelson was, there was a colloquy, so it is distinguishable. So maybe first before you go on.
That's almost more severe, though, because in Nelson there was a colloquy, and then the trial court violated her right under the, she had the colloquy and said, I want to testify.
Yes.
And then the trial court said no. So we have on the record a
– She knew her right, your opposing counsel would say, and was asserting her right. And the error was that there wasn't a recognition – of a proffered assertion. That was the error, not the inadequacy of a colloquy.
But I would say after Nelson, I would say that the remedy of the automatic evidentiary hearing becomes almost moot, because it's as if, let's assume the colloquy, let's assume that the defendant didn't know that she could testify. Well, what difference does it make? We need to know what she would have testified to. We need to know, there needs to be, at least an assertion that he would have testified.
Is it your position then in all, well, there was in the motion an assertion that he would testify, as I recalled. I read it this weekend, last week, but I recall that being in the motion and that he,
I don't think so. Okay. I could be wrong, but I don't think so.
Which case are we talking about, Nelson or this one?
This one.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. In Nelson, as I recall it, the state conceded or acknowledged error, didn't they?
Yes.
But the error again was in failing to, I thought, but correct me, the error was the not in
an inadequate colloquy, but failure to observe, if you will, an assertion of a right that was known. It wasn't like it was known and involuntary. It was the error was the failure to honor or observe an assertion of a right that the defendant knew or believed she had. Does that make sense to you? That's
right,
the way
but
that
I'd
I
say,
read error. That's the way I read Nelson.
But I'd say ultimately the problem is the defendant's testimony, whether it was from an inadequate colloquy or the trial court not letting her testify or not doing whatever it needed was should have done. The ultimate error was that the defendant's testimony wasn't presented to the fact finder.
Yeah, well, that's error. I mean, I always looked at Bangert as being kind of sui generis. And we have, not just, I look at it that way, we have case law. You've got the Bangert case, and several of us have written this in decisions. You have the Bangert case that deals with the adequacy of a colloquy. And then you have the other Nelson case, Bentley Nelson, that deals with non-colloquy. I mean, that there was, we've written this several times in our cases, that kind of distinction as to whether it's a Bangert case or whether it's the another Nelson case, Bentley. Bangert, Bentley, which one? Bangert deals only with the colloquy. The more recent Nelson case in 355 Wisconsin 2nd isn't a colloquy case, is it?
But my understanding is that the reason Bangert is the way it is because you've decided that if there's a failure in the colloquy, then that's it. But here, after Nelson, if there's a failure in the colloquy, we've now got this harmless error issue, which Bangert has never said that there can be a harmless error in the colloquy. If there's a failure in the colloquy, that's the end of the issue.
In Nelson, there was no failure of the colloquy. They had a colloquy relating to the NJI. Nelson said she wanted to testify. The trial court judge engaged Nelson in a colloquy about waiving a right against self-incrimination. The judge asked the lawyer, Nelson's lawyer, to explain all that carefully to her, which I assume happened, and then she indicated what she was going to say, right, when she testified. And the judge said, that's irrelevant. It has nothing to do with the issue of the NGI. Isn't that what happened in Nelson? And therefore, the judge said, no deal. You can't testify because your testimony is irrelevant. And the jury then convicted her. And she came back on this motion that she should have been able to testify, and the judge, before she even took the stand, should not have silenced her. And then the holding in Nelson was, either we assume it's error, or there was error in the judge refusing to let her testify, and that time to stop her on irrelevant was after the questions were asked, and she was going to say that. And the judge said, and the court said in Nelson, okay, it was error, but that it is harmless, right? And that changed the dynamic here so that harmless error applied when a defendant was barred from testifying in his or her own behalf. Now, is that a good enough summary for Nelson? Did I leave anything out that you think is important?
No.
Okay. So your position is harmless error therefore applies here. If it applies when there's definitely a denial of a constitutional right, then it sure should apply when there's it's all very vague here, right?
Right.
So harmless error would apply. Now, as I understand the defendant's position, is if we're going to apply Nelson, which happened after this case, right, which was released after this case.
I think it was on direct appeal.
Okay. then it should go back so they could fit under the Nelson harmless error, or not.
That's what I heard her say, yeah.
That's right. Okay. Do you think that should you prevail, either because there's no error or because it's harmless error, should it go back? Give them a chance under Nelson?
Well, I don't want to... May I answer that question? I read that, sorry.
Sure.
I don't... At the risk of sounding kind of draconian, I was on direct appeal, so there's that issue. And then, you know, we rebriefed it in the Court of Appeals with Nelson, and LeGrone didn't ask for that remedy there, and then didn't ask for it in briefing here. So
right.
This
the
is
remedy
the
that was asked for here in the brief is an evidentiary hearing.
Yeah, so I sort of think that that should have been asked for in the Court of Appeals when we rebriefed it following Nelson. So I would say no, I guess.
Is that Dracula?
Epiphany isn't going to work. Yours is a pro-defendant epiphany contrary to state, so it shouldn't work.
Okay. Yeah,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
I disagree with the state on all three points. So starting from the top, I disagree. I do believe that the right, the constitutional right to testify is fundamental at the second phase. As I stated earlier, because it is the defendant's burden. And second, because there are important interests at stake, as Justice Gableman pointed out, at issue is whether or not somebody goes to prison or somebody doesn't go to prison. And so for that reason, I believe that this court should first hold that this is a fundamental right at the second
Why,
phase.
In your estimation, does your opposing counsel's analogy to the parole situation with the administrative law judge, perhaps, and the reduction of procedural due process rights, why does that analogy fail in your estimation?
I believe that analogy fails because at that point, there has been a judgment of conviction entered. The person has been sentenced. It's much later down the line. At this point, while there has been a finding at the first phase of guilt, there has not yet been the judgment of conviction entered. The possibility is open whether or not there's a judgment of conviction versus whether or not there's a judgment of conviction. And so there are still these important liberty rights at stake versus by the time you get to the parole or the probation, the person has been sentenced and the judgment of conviction has been entered. And so for that reason, I think that that example is distinguishable from here. Second, I disagree with the state, and I do believe that this court should require a colloquy. As I was stating before, I believe that the right to testify is a fundamental constitutional right, and I believe it would be consistent with Weed, which applies in the first phase. It would be a very consistent result to require a colloquy when somebody is waiving the right to testify. So I think the colloquy, as the state had alluded to, it would ensure that the defendant understands and is aware of the rights. And quite frankly, I think that it eliminates a number of potential appellate issues because it's on the record and there's a colloquy and the defendant is saying, yes, I understand. And so I think a colloquy in this instance would be consistent with Weed and should be required at this second phase. I also don't think it would be more burdensome. There's already a jury instruction regarding the right to testify for the first phase. Take probably a matter of few seconds. I would note in this particular case, too, the court had done a jury trial waiver colloquy, and so it just would be a routine, easy, beneficial to require the colloquy at the second phase. I do believe that there could be confusion if you're saying the colloquy applies at one phase but not the other, and so I would ask that this court would require the colloquy at the second phase. And third, I do disagree that Nelson applies. Once again, as Justice Bradley was mentioning, I do believe that Nelson dealt with the assertion of a right. I think that this case is distinguishable because it deals with the intentional waiver and a colloquy. I think it's very akin to a Bangert. I also think that it would be in line with the Court of Appeals case Garcia. And so I would disagree that Nelson applies and would ask that this court remand or provide Mr. Legron an opportunity for an evidentiary hearing. Alternatively, if the court now does decide that Nelson applies and that there was this offer of proof required, I would just ask, in the interest of fairness, that Mr. Legron be given that opportunity to for a remand and to amend his pleadings accordingly. While as the state did note, this case was in briefing when Nelson came out, I just wanted to be clear that at the time the post-conviction motion was filed, the case law was under Garcia, Dentz, and Weed, and additionally, even on appeal, I think that, once again, I think there's an argument to be made that Nelson does not apply. So in the interest of fairness, I would just simply ask the court that if they do decide that Nelson is applicable, that we be given a chance to amend the pleadings accordingly. So for that reason, I'm asking three things. One, that this court find that there is a fundamental constitutional right to testify at the second phase. Two, that a colloquy is required. And then three, that the harmless error does not apply.
What do you think that the defendant would say at a hearing?
Well, I think, for instance, so there's two components in the answer. First is what the defendant actually would say. The defendant could provide what he was experiencing at the time. He could, in this particular case, for instance, write from the get-go, Mr. Legron had been on medication and then got off, so we could talk about the difference between being on medication, being on not, what might potentially trigger a schizophrenic attack. So I think that that would be important, but it's not just the what he would say that makes the right to testify so important. It would also be just an opportunity for the circuit court to hear, observe Mr. Legron's actions and demeanor, and see him respond to questions. I think particularly in this case, there were two experts, one for the state, one for the defense. And so I think it is important just in general that a defendant has this right and is aware that he or she has the right to testify at the second phase.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for a fine argument. Very, very interesting case with certainly some new wrinkles and cases like that. We are going to take a brief break now so that the students who are currently seated can leave and another group can come in. We convene for our second case.